And you are with The Shilling Show. Thanks for being with us. 977-1070, news, analysis, commentary, and insight, not only from the host, but also from a variety of guests, including a regular guest who's been with us for years here, and we're so pleased and fortunate to have him. David Morata is the president of Morata Wealth Management. Talking today and giving you an economics lesson on something you really need to understand. This is not theoretical, but this is real life. It's the economics of third-party payer systems, and we could think of that in terms of medicine and how medical insurance works, but it goes beyond that. Hey, David, welcome to The Shilling Show, and what a terrific topic.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
All right, let's start out by giving an explanation, because we hear these things, you know, third-party payer, single payer, you know, we don't understand what these are, some of the people listening, and so let's give a description.
Yeah, and it's interesting then that any college student who has Econ 101 or Econ 102, in the very first days of class, they'll go through some of the economics of supply and demand, and if students get that, I think that they will be libertarians for the rest of their lives, because they'll understand economics is all about the science of incentives, the science of personal choice, the science of rent seeking in government. And it's not a question for debate. There's more debate about things that that politically split us. But there is no debate in economics. There is economics, and economics is a fairly well proven science. Third party payer systems is any system in which the person who chooses the product doesn't pay the entire costs. So somehow the costs are paid either by insurance or by the government or by subsidizing or by price controls or something like that, and it ends up skewing the supply and demand curve. So I think in my article I talked about when my wife and I, when my wife had our first son, we were in the hospital, and at the end of the hospital we got a hospital bill. Now our costs due to our insurance were flat. They were so much that we had to pay for all the prenatal care and delivery, and everything else was going to be borne by insurance. And so in the hospital, we were looking at the charges, and we were looking, and they had a very expensive bedpan. We came to call it afterwards our $100 bedpan. it wasn't quite $100, but it seemed like it on the charge. And this was back in 1988.
That's
so,
when $100 was worth
$50. That's exactly, actually, yep. and then there was a charge for a box of Kleenex, and it was slightly less expensive, but it was still an incredibly expensive box of Kleenex. And we challenged the charges. We said we didn't use the Kleenex, we didn't use the bedpan. And they said, oh, don't worry about that, because your insurance pays for it, and we can't reuse it. Everything in the room has to get thrown away. So and so you're welcome to take the bedpan and the Kleenex home with you. And we took the Kleenex home and used them up, you know, in a week. And we took the bedpan home, and it was our sand toy for the next 20 years. We now had a child. When we went to the beach, we had a sand toy. It was our $100 bedpan. And a lot of people, you know, ask the question, why are there exorbitant hospital fees for things that you could buy at CVS? And it's a complex problem, but one of the big issues of why they can get away with charges like that are because they're third-party payer charges. Someone else is paying the bill, and there's no incentive for the hospital not to charge as much as possible, and there's no incentive for the patient to challenge it, even though many patients do. They're simply told, well, you're not paying for it anyway, so don't complain. It's just sign off the fact that there was a bedpan in your room, even if you didn't use it.
You know, this infuriates me, because I'm thinking about the recent decision here locally to start charging people for ambulance rides. You know, we had this system that was manned by volunteers, and people donated to the rescue squad. And for years, you know, they did this as a service to the community. And all of a sudden, the county gets involved. And I think they're sniffing out a revenue source here. And here is the logic. Well, we're never going to charge you. We're just going to put it off to your insurance company, as if there's no cost involved in that. And it sounds to me like the same thing. Is it the same thing?
It is the same thing, because a third-party payer system, there's no one who's – if you were actually charging that to individuals and you started charging, you know, $150 for an ambulance ride, then all of a sudden the patient would say, that's ridiculous. I'm not going to use an ambulance. Where if you have volunteers, it's a service to the community. And a volunteer organization, because it's not a third-party payer system, actually does things more efficiently. This is why charities do things much more efficiently than any government handouts. Government handouts are entitlements. Entitlements are then incentivized, and the incentivization then charges causes the price to get driven up because of the increased demand and because someone else is paying for it. So third-party payer systems explain a whole host of government spending. In fact, once you understand the economics of third-party payer system, you get mad at a lot of government spending because all government spending is really a third-party payer. Someone is paying for it, ultimately bearing the cost, and then government is paying for it, but government doesn't receive the benefit. Who receives the benefit is actually their constituent group, which has every incentive to drive the costs up.
Well, I have often chided our Board of Supervisors and City Council members by saying, you know, when I look at foolish spending going on that is unconstitutional and really unjustifiable on behalf of government, I said, if you came and had to come to me and stick your hand in my back pocket, I would slap you and tell you no. And yet they, through the power of government, are taking this and spreading the money around and then claiming credit for all the good things they're doing off of my money. And I said, you know, I hear too rarely, and for most of them, I hear never, this money belonged to somebody else. It should be treated with reverence because we took it from them.
I'm convinced there's a higher proportion of economists among libertarians because I think just the study of economics pushes you more toward libertarianism. But it also pushes you more toward a moral outrage that the big government advocates just don't get. They just don't understand why economists or libertarians get so angry about the waste of government spending because they don't have an economic lens to view it through. And they don't realize all of the unintended consequences that third-party payer systems wreak, not only on the wastefulness of spending, but also just upon the commerce of the economics of supply and demand. Every time there's a third-party payer system, it drives the cost up for people who don't have a third-party payer paying for them. And so people complained and complained and complained about the high cost of healthcare, but the high cost of healthcare is driven mostly by the third-party payer system of Medicare. Medicare was provided the model for health insurance, and health insurance and Medicare together in the third-party payer system have driven up the costs, whereas the costs would be much, much more reasonable without those third-party payer systems.
I guess the ultimate problem here is a lack of education, and it goes back to having an informed electorate. So if people either didn't get an economics class or were not paying attention to economics or were taught Keynesian economics instead of real economics, I guess they're not equipped to make good decisions?
It's true that the majority, the 51% majority voting for goodies is never a good idea. We have a problem with democracy in that we have not, even though the Constitution tried, we have not successfully constrained the power of government such that a 51% majority can mandate that you must buy a certain product and call it a tax. And given that lack of constraint, even though our forefathers tried so hard to produce a limited government, they did not have in their minds the wiliness of the 51% majority to vote themselves bread and circuses.
Yeah, it's diabolical, really. David Morata is our guest. 977-1070 is the phone number. We welcome your comments, questions, criticisms, challenges, all here. Ellie stands by at 977-1070, or if you happen to be a little outside of the listening area, it's 434-977-1070. That's the phone number here on The Shilling Show. We're talking about the economics of third-party payer systems and much, much more on the other side of the break. So stay with us. Gosh, I hope the mic wasn't on for that last conversation. We're not going to tell you what it was. Certainly not for over the air. All right. It is lunchtime after all. 12. It was medically related. I'll say that. It's 12:34 here on The Shilling Show. David Morata joins us on the economics of third-party payer systems. By the way, David is online at moradaonmoney.com, and he's got some terrific articles on this topic up online at the website. It's a great, great resource for you. He's done a lot of research into these things and has, I think, some great opinion pieces there. Okay, so let's go to this understanding of the third-party payer system. You mentioned that government is like that. Something else you brought up in one of your pieces was education, and I thought that was a terrific thing. Let's talk about third-party payer and the cost of education, because people should be aware.
Yeah, so a little bit about how a third-party payer system drives up costs. So if there's some equilibrium between supply and demand, we'll use education as our example, in terms of the number of kids that are going to college every year. Mm-hmm. So you've got young people who are going to college. There used to be an equilibrium between trade schools and a traditional four-year college. The cost of college was held down because they actually had to attract people. it's not clear if you want to go start a sandwich shop or a trade or a business, or you want to apprentice under some master carpenter, that going to college for 4 years is necessarily the best thing to do. And colleges had to attract people. One, they had to attract people by giving really good service, by helping their alums, by keeping the costs down. They knew that, that people were going, were paying out of their own pocket, and people appreciated it more when they went to college. So now you get a third-party payer system, which is the government, and the government gives out all kinds of grants and loans and things to give out money in order for you to have a free ride, not only the cost of college, but the cost of room and board and and transportation and everything else. And what that does is that means that so long as the government or the college is willing to take government student loans, they can encourage and help students to get student loans, to rack up huge student loans. The college gets paid for all of that, and that increases demand so that people who otherwise couldn't pay the college will now pay the college. And the cost of a college education then is driven up by the higher demand. And you see that in some very elite schools where it was hard to get into have just taken more and more and more students, such that now it's actually easier to get into. Law school being one of them. Law schools are now fairly easy to get into, and some law schools that were very hard to get into are now actually having trouble because the increase of demand, they've increased their capacity to help match it, and the costs have gone up because people don't care what they're getting charged because someone else is paying for it. And maybe it's mom and dad, and maybe it's the government, and maybe it's a Pell Grant, and maybe it's just a student loan that they're not actually thinking about. They think it's free money. And so that increases the cost for everyone else, such that if you're not on one of those, if you're actually trying to work and pay your own way through college, it's now much, much more expensive because the increased demand has pushed up cost. And the reason it's pushed up cost is because while colleges were running just fine at their current enrollment, they had to start adding additional things in order to push their enrollment higher and higher. And in order to meet a greater supply, sometimes there's a diminishing law of returns where it costs more to continually add more and more students, such that you have to expend more money.
And I see the politicians taking great advantage of this. I see Mark Warner and Tim Kaine. You know, we're gonna do this for you, gonna relieve your burden. And again, it's a function of not understanding economics, because the point you make is very clear. A couple years ago when George Allen was running, I couldn't believe it, and I made a comment on this in a blog post about it. This group of college Republicans was lauding the fact that George Allen did more, in other words, gave more money to college students than whoever his opponent was. I don't remember who they were comparing him to at the time. It might have been Jim Webb, but it's like, hey, George Allen gave us a lot more money. We should vote for him. And I wrote, are you really Republicans? Are you small government people? This is nothing to be proud of.
Yeah, this is one place where libertarians say both Republicans and Democrats are guilty of thinking that the third-party payer system is somehow good. If you look at the two things that government has tried to help funding in order to bring down the cost for people, and that is a college education and healthcare, and you look at what's actually happened to the college expenses and healthcare expenses, they have gone up multiples of the inflation rate every year because of the third-party payer system driving costs up until they're unaffordable without someone else paying for them. And the odd thing about the third-party payer system is the solution to the third-party payer system is to stop subsidizing it in order to bring the cost down. And that seems so terrible because no one can afford right now, no one can afford health care and no one can afford a college education because of the subsidization, not in spite of it. And not then the subsidization doesn't make it less expensive or more affordable. It makes it more expensive and less affordable. And that's why libertarians end up getting mad almost at the idiocy of comments about funding college education and funding healthcare. And this has nothing to do with whether or not college education and healthcare are good expenditures. It may be that we would be spending more on healthcare than we were in the past simply because there's better procedures, but it wouldn't be as bad as it is today.
Let's just say theoretically that the General Assembly goes in and says, okay, we're gonna cut off all the aid to the University of Virginia, all of this federal money coming in, the grants and all that. It's gone. As of January 1. So January 2 and on, what happens at the University of Virginia? They just throw their hands up and shut the doors, or would cooler heads prevail?
Yeah, I think what would happen is, one, the University of Virginia would have to figure out how to contain costs. which they don't have an incentive for that as much today. They have some incentive, but not very much incentive, because the money continues to flow in from students, and since the students aren't paying for a lot of it, most students are on some sort of a scholarship or a ride, that they don't challenge the bills as much. And then second, students would have to figure out, is a college education really worth it? And they'd start making the decision, for example, that the least expensive way to get a University of Virginia diploma is to go 2 years out at PVCC. It's an incredible deal. Get good grades, which is another thing that students actually don't have an incentive for today.
Sure.
And then transfer to the University of Virginia and do their last 2 years there. That would cut their costs virtually in half, which is an incredible cost savings. Why don't more students do that? Because it's a guaranteed way of getting into the University of Virginia right now. Why don't more students do that? Well, third-party payer system. It doesn't really matter. And I'd rather have the University of Virginia experience for all 4 years, because that marginal benefit doesn't cost me anything. And therefore, I'm willing to go the route of just racking up loans or getting grants or getting student aid.
And I think part of the problem is it really does cost them something. It costs them a lot. They're just not seeing it yet or feeling the pain, but it's out there. Let's go to the phones and say hi to Chris. Hey, Chris, welcome to the Schilling Show. You're on with David Morata.
Thanks, Rob. David, I wanted to go back to the health care bill really quickly, the law now, about the ethics of it. You know, the process that they put through to get that in front of the Supreme Court is what FDR did with his legislation for Social Security and welfare back in, you know, the good old days of World War II, whatever, or before then, actually, where they passed the legislation in the legislature as being a insurance policy. Now, this is what FDR said. And then when they got in front of the Supreme Court, his lawyer said, no, it's not insurance policy, it's tax. And this is exactly what Obama did. So he must have been reading FDR's notes or whatever. It's very unethical in my mind. It's an abuse of power, and they should have put the legislation back through, as far as I'm concerned, as a tax, because it never would have passed. And I just wanted to get your opinion on it.
Yeah, I completely agree that any time the government is coercing us to buy certain products or even buying them on our behalf, it's an abuse of power. It's a lack of freedom, and there's a lot of those. It's one reason why libertarians get visibly upset and shaken, and we should, because that's the only way of, until people see that this is a form of curtailing freedoms, and it's a horrible affront on our sensibilities, both economic and moral, the rest of society kind of says, oh, we'll quit worrying about it, and you know, it's just like everything else that's going on in society. I think the biggest fault of government is the mentality of one size fits all. Malcolm Gladwell has a great talk on just the whole idea of having different kind of products. He was helping Diet Pepsi produce the best Diet Pepsi, and what they learned was there isn't one best Diet Pepsi. Different people like different things, and you can see that in the private sector, where you see, you know, 17 different kinds of mustard and 27 different kinds of mayonnaise. And what the government is trying to say is everybody needs this particular kind of mayonnaise. It's the only kind of mayonnaise. It doesn't matter if you're intolerant to eggs and you can't actually eat one of the ingredients. We're going to shove this down your throat. If you look at healthcare, there are so many different variety of needs. And there are some people who, at the government prices of mandated and pushing up prices and requiring the young to pay, they actually just shouldn't have health care. Mm-hmm. It's not a good deal, and they shouldn't have it. And yet the government is trying to say, we're going to shove this down poor, young, healthy people's throats and make them subsidize all of the old, sick people who smoke and eat too much and have too many trans fats.
Sounds downright un-American. 977-1070 is the phone number. Our guest is David Morata. We have one more segment here with an economics lesson today that has practical applications for you, taxpayers and voters, people who are concerned with the quality of health care they receive and really how the economy works. You need to be aware of it. 977-1070, The Schilling Show, back with David Morata in just a moment. Final segment with David Morata this hour. the economics of third-party payer systems. JC writes in, I think you mean young people don't need health insurance. Everybody should get health care if they need it, and young people may need health care, but health insurance is ungodly expensive for them. So maybe we just want to make sure that that's clear. Okay, let's go to the phones. Thanks, JC. Let's go to the phones and say hello to Greg. Hi, Greg. You're on with David.
Hey, David. Very quickly, you know, this started a long time ago, this crony socialism, basically where you've got the socialists and their regulations and the crony capitalists. You know, when you build a house now, you might have the best lumber on your property you could possibly use, but you can't build a house, especially in Albemarle County and most counties, Virginia, because building codes require all that lumber to be graded. Well, that started this lumber grading way back when, and what it allowed is the big companies could afford to have that done by a grader or engineer and get a stamp, their lumber stamp. They had a market where you had to go to their market because the little sawmill guy couldn't put all that together. Well, it's just graduated up through health care. And they basically are going to tell you what you're going to do, but the big corporatists will deal with it and like it because then they have the corner on the market because they can afford to do those things, i.e. the big insurance companies with Obamacare. But this whole thing is crony socialism and crony capitalism, and they're all in it together. And so the little guys who want to be free are shot right out of the market to do what they want on their property and with their businesses. And I'll just sign off and listen.
All right, let's get a comment from David.
Yeah, Greg is completely right that when you see an industry requesting regulation on itself, you know there's something wrong, and you know that they're requesting regulation in order to quell and squash their competition. We have that in the financial industry, which I'm much more familiar with, between members of FINRA, which is the broker-dealer association, and fee-only financial advisors who are only regulated by the SEC. FINRA would like to put a lot of regulations on the fee-only financial planning world. They are probably 88% to 93% of the financial services individuals are working with a broker-dealer. They're commission-based agents. And the kinds of regulations that they want to put on the entire industry, one, are not necessary for fee-only financial advisors, but second, are also onerous for fee-only financial advisors. And so that kind of quelling of competition to request your own industry to be regulated in a way that suits you and doesn't suit your competition is huge. And Greg brings out rightly yet another case, which is graded lumber. You can look at it as taxi medallions. You know, there's a thousand different, you know, poster children in economics for those kinds of regulations in decreasing competition and increasing costs and decreasing quality, even when you're trying to do something like making sure your lumber is graded and increase quality. Well, if your lumber is graded and according to pass, you know, to pass the codes, it has to be graded a C. And you would have used A lumber had it not been graded, but now that it's graded, you can only afford C lumber. You're actually getting less quality because of the regulation than you would have gotten had you not had the regulation. And most people don't realize that that regulation costs a lot of money. So, for example, in healthcare, about half of the costs of your doctor visit are just the doctor trying to get reimbursed from Medicare or insurance. And would they not have, you know, if you paid cash on the way in, they would be able to charge half as much and fire half their staff.
But they're not legally allowed to,
no,
to
they're
give
not,
cash pricing.
Right, they're not legally allowed to. And they're not legally allowed to have a discount for cash.
Yeah, why not?
Because Medicare says we want the lowest possible cost, and if you're willing to pay cash, have a cash price for someone else, then you have to have that price for us. Mm. When in fact, that price for them is unsustainable because it costs them twice as much just to get reimbursed. There is no, oh, we have to file for your insurance fee that doctors are allowed to tack on. But were they allowed to tack that on, the rest of us who are willing to pay cash would make out like bandits.
So why don't we just fix prices on everything? We did try this before. I remember WHIP inflation now, the little win buttons, and we remember the Price and Wage Controls Institute, I believe, during the Nixon years. Why don't we just do that here and just say, you know what? Here's what you can charge. That's the national rate, and take it or leave it.
Yeah, it's interesting. That was actually some of the first steps in Medicare. They decided that they would have fixed costs for everything. And doctors said, well, you know, that's not really good because if I have a practice in Manhattan versus a practice in Crozet, it really costs different amounts. So initially, Medicare fixed prices based upon your locality and the cost of living there, which meant they would pay more money if you were in Manhattan than they'd pay in Crozet. They so incentivized working in Manhattan that they actually produced a dearth of doctors out in the rural areas that need it the most. And so they actually grabbed doctors out of underserved areas, and they dragged them into Manhattan with their incentives. And that caused terrible problems in the insurance industry and the Medicare industry. So I think the biggest answer is that there is only one force which has all of the different incentives in place right, and that is the market force. So any government official who's trying to set prices on things will get them wrong, and they'll either push prices up to what they're willing to pay because they charge too much, or else they will produce shortages because they're not actually willing to pay enough. And hey, if I want to pay more because I want my doctor to be out in Crozet, where I live, shouldn't I be able to do that? And so they have done fixing of prices, and because of they've fixed some prices too low, doctors make up for it by charging $100 bedpans.
You know, I'm not sure if we covered this on a previous program, but I heard somebody, and it might have even been you who brought this to me, talking about the anti-gouging, quote-unquote anti-gouging laws, and how that really is contrary to the market. Because when prices increase due to a natural disaster, let's say generator prices double, then the market will direct more generators into that market where they are needed to make up for it. And if you don't allow the market to work and you artificially cap the rates, well, they're going to be staying out in the middle of Minnesota or wherever they are that are not needed and not coming to Virginia. And people just don't seem to get a grip on this.
It's true. The same thing is true for bottled water. If bottled water is suddenly needed someplace, and you're selling it for a dollar, I'll go in and buy twice as much as I need just in case. But if you're selling it for $5 a bottle because now it's a scarce resource in my area, I'll buy exactly what I need and leave the rest for other people for exactly what they need. Yeah, the market is in the short term, it can be very fickle. But in the long term especially, it is brilliant at putting prices exactly where they should be.
Absolutely. David Morata, thank you so much. It's been a great hour. We had to have this played for all the local high school students.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
And by the way, he's online at moratamoney.com. This will be podcast. So if you would like to share this with your friends, this conversation, very important, you can do so. Ellie will have the podcast up in just a few minutes, and the podcasts are online at shillingshow.com or WINA.com. Coming up in hour number two of today's edition of The Shilling Show, it is Supervisor Ken Boyd. He will be here in studio with us. We've got a lot to talk about, including Route 29 update, what's going on with the scheduling of all of these items that are supposed to take place. Also, formation of an economic development office in Albemarle County, the board's changing a meeting schedule, and Charbonneville. Ah, one community indeed. All that coming up, including open phones, and you can call in and get in line right now. We'd love to hear from you at 977-1070. That's 434-977-1070. Rob S. at WINA.com is the email. Shilling Show back in just a moment.